You're listening to In the Vault, a KPMG banking industry podcast series.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Liz Lamadou, a principal in KPMG's banking and capital markets tax practice. And today, I'm joined by three of my banking colleagues, and we're going to talk about the employee retention tax credit, which is getting a lot of interest in the banking industry right now. So I'd like to introduce Mike George and Stacey Jansen, both managing directors, and Sally Hawkins, a senior manager, all members of KPMG's banking and capital markets tax practice. Welcome, team.
Hey, Liz.
Hey, thanks for having us.
So as I mentioned, we're going to talk about the employee retention credit, or ERC. So diving in, why don't we start with the basics? Sally, can you talk to us about what is the employee retention credit and why is it getting so much attention now?
Definitely. So the employee retention credit is a credit that rewards companies for retaining their employees during COVID. And, you know, even when things got rough, they did the right thing and continued to pay their employees, even when maybe they weren't able to perform all their tasks that they normally did, or, you know, when they are perhaps in a different financial position than they were in pre-COVID. But nonetheless, it is aimed at rewarding companies who continue to pay their employees. And it's getting a lot of attention now because there's a cash benefit for the employee retention credit, even for companies who are in NOL, so net operating losses. And the most important part here is that the clock is ticking to be able to claim the employee retention credit. For the 2020 tax year, we're running up on about 9 months there until the statute closes. There's a little bit more time for the 2021 tax year, but nonetheless, unfortunately, the credits do take about 6 to 12 months to be able to process. Therefore, I think the earlier you can get your credit claims in, the sooner you'll be in line to actually get the refund.
Okay, so we're looking at a 4-year statute of limitations. And so for those that early part of 2020, the statute runs early in 2024. So that's why folks are looking at this now, if they haven't claimed it, to get that claim in on time.
Correct. Yeah. So the statute for 2020 closes on April 15th of 2024. For the 2021 tax year, it begins to close on April 15th, 2025. But nonetheless, I think for 2020, the statute is approaching.
Okay. So that makes sense why we're starting to see some attention around this right now. But Sally, can you talk to us about what is the benefit? What are the credit amounts? And is it different rules for different sizes of banks?
There are. So there's a maximum benefit for 2020 of about $5,000 per person, and that's based on a $10,000 of eligible wages. In 21, the benefit became much more lucrative, and it's a maximum of $7,000 a person per quarter for 2021. And sorry, well, that would only be for the first 3 quarters. Unfortunately, the ERC went away for Q4, but that would still be based on that $10,000 of eligible wages. And I think within here, what's important to note is that there's a concept of a small employer and a large employer. And if you're a small employer, you would get the credit for each person, even if they were working normally or even if they worked more than ever, where if you're a large employer, your credit amount is going to be limited to the what you've paid people who are unable to work. So that could be the time when, say, a bank branch was closed or you had an early closure and you paid employees their normal salaries, even if they weren't providing services. Or if you had additional COVID PTO that you allocated to employees for quarantine or illness or childcare, even if this was something that was mandated, say, by state law or by the FFCRA. But again, getting back to the small employer, so that would be someone who's has less than 100 people in 2020 or less than 500 people in 2021. And if you're a small employer, again, as I mentioned earlier, you would get that credit per person, again, assuming that you would qualify for the ERC in the respective quarter or in the respective year, if we're talking about the 2020 tax year. So really how that works, for example, is if in Q1 of 21, you paid someone, say, $3,500 a month, which is equivalent to, you know, the low $40,000 a year in salary. And if you qualified in Q1 of 2021 as an eligible employer, you can get $7,000 of credit for that person if you are a small employer. So kind of thinking about that on a larger scale, if you had 500 people and you just for 21 capped out at that, you know, 500 threshold to be a small employer in 21, and each person maxed out on those $10,000 in wages, that would almost be about $3.5 million of ERC just for that quarter. And then if you were to qualify in all three quarters and you had 500 people, and again, you are an eligible employer, that would be about 10.5 million. So there's a benefit for any size of company. But I think what we want to point out here is that sometimes the smaller that you are, the more benefit there could be if we did determine that you qualified.
Agreed. That definitely sounds like some lucrative benefits. So why don't you talk us through how it is a bank qualifies?
Yeah, so there's two different ways to qualify. And of course, we'll go into a little bit more detail on each after this. But the first test is a gross receipts test. And this really just measures those financial impacts that companies may have experienced during COVID. The second test is a partial suspension test. So really what this gauges is the operational impacts that COVID restrictions might have had on your operations as an employer. And the good news is that you do not need to meet both tests in any given quarter to qualify. It's one or the other. And also, each quarter is measured individually. So if you could meet a gross receipts test in one quarter, and the next quarter you can meet that partial suspension test, and they're both equal, you would receive the same benefit if you would meet one or two, or one of those two tests.
Great. Thanks, Sally. And what is the gross receipts test? Mike, can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, like Sally mentioned, one of the ways to be an eligible employer is through the significant reduction in gross receipts test. This is a quantitative test, and the way I like to describe it is you're comparing post-COVID to pre-COVID. So for 2020, you would meet the decline in gross receipts test if your receipts for a particular quarter in 2020 are 50% less than what they were in the same calendar quarter in 2019. So again, you're comparing pre-COVID to post-COVID. For 2021, there was a law change and it became a little bit easier to qualify under the gross receipts test. In 2021, you would be looking for a 20% reduction in gross receipts from the quarter in 2021 when comparing it to 2019. Like Sally mentioned, this is a quarterly test, so it's possible you qualify for certain quarters and not others. But again, it's a pretty straight way to, you know, assess your qualifications for the credit.
What's typically included in gross receipts, and how are you seeing banks qualify for this?
It's a great question. So for purposes of the ERC, gross receipts has the same meaning as when used under Section 440C of the Internal Revenue Code. You know, that code section, the regs list out a number of things, but it includes things such as sales, service income, income from investments, interest income, dividends, rents, royalties, etc. So maybe to just give a little bit of industry insight, the main gross receipt for a bank in that list I just went through obviously would probably be interest income. And so when you go back to the rules again, you're comparing 2019 to 2020 or 2019 to 2021. So if you take a step back and you think, you know, what happened to interest rates between 2019 and 2021, they went down and they went down quite a bit. So interest income for a number of our banks was impacted. And again, the gross receipts test looks at the revenue side, not expense side. So even though a bank's net interest income may have been flat or may have stayed stable or improved slightly, we're only looking at the revenue side. So we had a number of banks qualify under the significant reduction in gross receipts test, and it was largely driven by the reduction in their interest revenue. So again, you would have to look at all your gross receipts, not just interest. You know, some banks might have made up for the reduction in interest revenue just by increasing their volume, or they could have had offsetting increases in fee income. You know, I just wanted to raise this point because it's not inconceivable that banks had a reduction in gross receipts. And like I mentioned, we've seen some fact patterns where banks have met this reduction. And it was, like I said, largely driven by the reduction in interest income.
That makes sense. And so the other way to qualify then is operationally and through a partial shutdown. Stacy, do you have some examples of that would help us?
Yeah, so as we have been talking to some of the banks across the country, all of them had to change the way they did business. And some of the more prevalent ones are they would implement drive-through only service, but they still paid all the staff regardless of if they were working the drive-through, or they would change to do appointment only if they actually let people come into the branch, and they still didn't cut any hours or pay for the staff that weren't getting to work full time since people weren't out and about as much. Some of the other things, they would put their staff on an A and B shift model. So half the staff would work for 2 weeks while the other half of the staff would stay at home in case somebody got COVID and ended up having to quarantine, they wouldn't have to shut the whole branch down. They would just switch to the B shift and the A shift would go home. Some other things that they have done is they would have to reduce the branch operating hours because they would have to disinfect because there was a COVID outbreak, or they were trying to hedge against a COVID outbreak, stuff like that.
Thanks. That's helpful. And so a branch didn't have to entirely shut down in order to qualify for the credit.
Correct. They just had to be more than nominally impacted.
Yeah. And so I think, Liz, to your point too, and what we typically see in terms of the impacts are that a lot of times branches, as Stacey mentioned earlier, they go to a drive-through only model, right? Or they would go to an appointment only model, or they would be open for reduced hours. And so therefore, you know, that the branches weren't closed completely, and that's okay. The test here is that there was at least a partial suspension of operations and that had a nominal impact on your business. And typically what we see is that, you know, the branches in terms of headcounts, revenues, however you measure it, are more than are a substantial portion of a bank's business. And therefore, I think when those are shut down or they're not able to, you know, operate as they normally would, that tends to lend itself to a partial suspension.
I'd like to find out more about how a bank actually claims this credit. So, Sally, what does a bank do?
So the bank would claim this on their Form 941, which is their payroll tax filing. So essentially, you would be amending the Form 941. So you'd file a Form 941X to claim the employee retention credit.
Does this impact taxable income when the bank gets the employment tax refunded?
It will. While the credit is very lucrative, you will have to pay tax on that.
Okay. Mike, do you want to talk us through how this gets recorded?
Sure. Great question. You know, as we talked through, this is not an income tax credit, but rather is a payroll tax credit. So something in the accounting space we refer to as a non-income based credit. And the good news is it's not recorded in income tax expense in the financials, but instead it's recorded above the line as a benefit to pre-tax earnings. So that excites, you know, a lot of our banks to kind of get a boost to earnings from this credit. There's a couple of different ways to account for the credit. There's some diversity in practice, but the punchline is since a portion of this credit would be refundable if it exceeds your payroll taxes, it's determined to be a grant. And so US GAAP doesn't have specific guidance on how entities should account for grants. Like I mentioned, there's diversity in practice, but our accounting for income taxes handbook, and I believe the other firms as well, kind of walk through some different types of accounting you can apply by analogy. So some clients apply IAS 20, which is accounting for government grants. Some clients have applied subtopic 450-30, which is gain contingencies. And then some clients have looked to revenue recognition standards to determine how to record it. But again, the key point, it's recorded above the line in pre-tax earnings.
Yeah. I was going to say, Mike, you had me at above the line. And so, yeah, interesting. So there may be different ways to record that, but everyone should check with their financial statement auditors, it sounds like.
Yep.
So let me recap what we've talked about. There's a lucrative credit out there, the ERC, that applies to employment taxes paid. There's a couple of different ways that banks can qualify, both under a gross receipts method or under a partial shutdown of operations method. There's different rules and credit amounts depending on the different size of banks, but both can be extremely lucrative. And the statute runs in a little under a year for anyone trying to make a claim for 2020. So I think that explains why we're seeing so much activity around this right now in the banking space. People are gearing up to see if they qualify and to get those claims in before a statute runs. Have I got that right, guys?
You got it.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you talking us through this today and sharing your insights. It was a good discussion. I definitely learned some things. And to our audience, thank you for joining us today. This is Liz Lamadou on behalf of KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. I look forward to talking again soon.
Thanks for listening to In the Vault with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this series to be notified of new episodes.